Murmur to those indefatigable spirits who consecrate their vigils to the amelioration or to the alleviation of their kind. Honour, thrice honour. Is it not time to cry that the blind shall see, the deaf hear, the lame walk? But that which fanaticism formerly promised to its elect, science now accomplishes for all men. We shall keep our readers informed as to the successive phases of this remarkable cure. This did not prevent Mère Lefrançois from coming 5 days after, scared and crying out, "Help! He's dying! I am going crazy!" Charles rushed to the Lion d'Or, and the chemist, who caught sight of him passing along the Place hatless, abandoned his shop. He appeared himself, breathless, red, anxious, and asking everyone who was going up the stairs, "Why, what's the matter with our interesting strephopode?" The strephopode was writhing in hideous convulsions, so that the machine in which his leg was enclosed was knocked against the wall enough to break it. With many precautions, in order not to disturb the position of the limb, the box was removed, and an awful sight presented itself. The outlines of the foot disappeared in such a swelling that the entire skin seemed about to burst, and it was covered with ecchymosis caused by the famous machine. Hippolyte had already complained of suffering from it. No attention had been paid to him. They had to acknowledge that he had not been altogether wrong, and he was freed for a few hours. But hardly had the edema gone down to some extent than the two savants thought fit to put back the limb in the apparatus, strapping it tighter to hasten matters. At last, 3 days after, Hippolyte being unable to endure it any longer, they once more removed the machine, and were much surprised at the result they saw. The livid tumefaction spread over the leg with blisters here and there, whence there oozed a black liquid. Matters were taking a serious turn. Hippolyte began to worry himself, and Mère Lefrançois had him installed in the little room near the kitchen, so that he might at least have some distraction. But the tax collector, who dined there every day, complained bitterly of such companionship. Then Hippolyte was removed to the billiard room. He lay there, moaning under his heavy coverings, pale, with long beard, sunken eyes, and from time to time turning his perspiring head on the dirty pillow where the flies alighted. Madame Bovary went to see him. She brought him linen for his poultices. She comforted and encouraged him. Besides, he did not want for company, especially on market days, when the peasants were knocking about the billiard balls round him, fenced with the queues, smoked, drank, sang, and brawled. "How are you?" they said, clapping him on the shoulder. "Ah, you're not up to much, it seems, but it's your own fault. You should do this, do that." And then they told him stories of people who had all been cured by other remedies than his. Then, by way of consolation, they added, "You give way too much. Get up. You cuddle yourself like a king. All the same, old chap, you don't smell nice." Gangrene, in fact, was spreading more and more. Bovary himself turned sick at it. He came every hour, every moment. Hippolyte looked at him with eyes full of terror, sobbing, "When shall I get well? Oh, save me! How unfortunate I am! How unfortunate I am!" And the doctor left, always recommending him to diet himself. "Don't listen to him, my lad," said Mère Lefrançois. "Haven't they tortured you enough already? You'll grow still weaker. Here, swallow this." And she gave him some good beef tea, a slice of mutton, a piece of bacon, and sometimes small glasses of brandy that he had not the strength to put to his lips. Abbé Bournisien, hearing that he was growing worse, asked to see him. He began by pitying his sufferings, declaring at the same time that he ought to rejoice at them, since it was the will of the Lord, and take advantage of the occasion to reconcile himself to heaven. "For," said the ecclesiastic in a paternal tone, "you rather neglected your duties. You were rarely seen at divine worship. How many years is it since you approached the holy table? I understand that your work, that the whirl of the world, may have kept you from care for your salvation, but now is the time to reflect. Yet don't despair. I have known great sinners who, about to appear before God, you are not yet at this point, I know, had implored his mercy, and who certainly died in the best frame of mind. Let us hope that, like them, you will set us a good example. Thus, as a precaution, what is to prevent you from saying morning and evening, 'Hail Mary, full of grace, and Our Father which art in heaven'? Yes, do that, for my sake, to oblige me. That won't cost you anything. Will you promise me? The poor devil promised. The curé came back day after day. He chatted with the landlady and even told anecdotes, interspersed with jokes and puns that Hippolyte did not understand. Then, as soon as he could, he fell back upon matters of religion, putting on an appropriate expression of face. His zeal seemed successful, for the Clubfoot soon manifested a desire to go on a pilgrimage to Bon Secours if he were cured, to which Monsieur Bournisien replied that he saw no objection. Two precautions were better than one. It was no risk, anyhow. The druggist was indignant at what he called the manoeuvres of the priest. They were prejudicial, he said, to Hippolyte's convalescence, and he kept repeating to Madame Lefrancois, "Leave him alone, leave him alone. You perturb his morals with your mysticism." But the good woman would no longer listen to him. He was the cause of it all. From a spirit of contradiction, she hung up near the bedside of the patient a basin filled with holy water and a branch of box. Religion, however, seemed no more able to succour him than surgery, and the invincible gangrene still spread from the extremities towards the stomach. It was all very well to vary the potions and change the poultices. The muscles each day rotted more and more. And at last Charles replied by an affirmative nod of the head when Mère Lefrancois asked him if she could not, as a forlorn hope, send for Monsieur Canivet of Neufchâtel, who was a celebrity. A doctor of medicine, 50 years of age, enjoying a good position and self-possessed, Charles's colleague did not refrain from laughing disdainfully when he had uncovered the leg, mortified to the knee. Then, having flatly declared that it must be amputated, he went off to the chemist's to rail at the asses who could have reduced a poor man to such a state. Shaking Monsieur Homais by the button of his coat, he shouted out in the shop, "These are the inventions of Paris! These are the ideas of those gentry of the capital. It is like strabismus, chloroform, lithotrity, a heap of monstrosities that the government ought to prohibit. But they want to do the clever, and they cram you with remedies without troubling about the consequences. We are not so clever, not we. We are not savants, coxcombs, fops. We are practitioners. We cure people, and we should not dream of operating on anyone who is in perfect health. Straighten club feet. As if one could straighten club feet. It is as if one wished, for example, to make a hunchback straight." Homais suffered as he listened to this discourse, and he concealed his discomfort beneath a courtier's smile, for he needed to humour Monsieur Canivet, whose prescriptions sometimes came as far as Yonville. So he did not take up the defence of Bovary. He did not even make a single remark, and renouncing his principles, he sacrificed his dignity to the more serious interests of his business. This amputation of the thigh by Dr. Canivet was a great event in the village. On that day all the inhabitants got up earlier, and the Grande Rue, although full of people, had something lugubrious about it, as if an execution had been expected. At the grocer's they discussed Hippolyte's illness. The shops did no business, and Madame Tuvache, the mayor's wife, did not stir from her window, such was her impatience to see the operator arrive. He came in his gig, which he drove himself. But the springs of the right side having at length given way beneath the weight of his corpulence, it happened that the carriage, as it rolled along, leaned over a little, and on the other cushion near him could be seen a large box covered in red sheep leather, whose three brass clasps shone grandly. After he had entered, like a whirlwind, the porch of the Lion d'Or, the doctor, shouting very loud, ordered them to unharness his horse. Then he went into the stable to see that he was eating his oats all right, for on arriving at a patient's he first of all looked after his mare and his gig. People even said about this, "Ah, Monsieur Canivet's a character!" And he was the more esteemed for this imperturbable coolness. The universe to the last man might have died, and he would not have missed the smallest of his habits. Homais presented himself. "I count on you," said the doctor. "Are we ready? Come along." But the druggist, turning red, confessed that he was too sensitive to assist at such an operation. "When one is a simple spectator," he said, "the imagination, you know, is impressed, and then I have such a nervous system." "Pshaw!" interrupted Canivet. "On the contrary, you seem to me inclined to apoplexy. Besides, that doesn't astonish me, for you chemist fellows are always poking about your kitchens, which must end by spoiling your constitutions. Now just look at me. I get up every day at 4 o'clock, I shave with cold water, and am never cold. I don't wear flannels, and I never catch cold. My carcass is good enough. I live now in one way, now in another, like a philosopher, taking potluck. That is why I'm not squeamish like you, and it is as indifferent to me to carve a Christian as the first fowl that turns up. Then perhaps you will say, habit, habit. Then, without any consideration for Hippolyte, who was sweating with agony between his sheets, these gentlemen entered into a conversation in which the druggist compared the coolness of a surgeon to that of a general. And this comparison was pleasing to Canivet, who launched out on the exigencies of his art. He looked upon it as a sacred office, although the ordinary practitioners dishonoured it. At last, coming back to the patient, he examined the bandages brought by Homais, the same that had appeared for the club foot, and asked for someone to hold the limb for him. Lestiboudois was sent for, and Monsieur Canivet, having turned up his sleeves, passed into the billiard room, while the druggist stayed with Artemis and the landlady, both whiter than their aprons and with ears strained towards the door. Bovary, during this time, did not dare to stir from his house. He kept downstairs in the sitting-room by the side of the fireless chimney, his chin on his breast, his hands clasped, his eyes staring. What a mishap, he thought. What a mishap! Perhaps, after all, he had made some slip. He thought it over, but could hit upon nothing. But the most famous surgeons also made mistakes, and that is what no one would ever believe. People, on the contrary, would laugh, jeer. It would spread as far as Forges, as Neufchâtel, as Rouen, everywhere. Who could say if his colleagues would not write against him? Polemics would ensue. He would have to answer in the papers. Hippolyte might even prosecute him. He saw himself dishonoured, ruined, lost. And his imagination, assailed by a world of hypotheses, tossed amongst them like an empty cask borne by the sea and floating upon the waves. Emma, opposite, watched him. She did not share his humiliation. She felt another, that of having supposed such a man was worth anything, as if 20 times already she had not sufficiently perceived his mediocrity. Charles was walking up and down the room. His boots creaked on the floor. "Sit down," she said. "You fidget me." He sat down again. How was it that she who was so intelligent, could have allowed herself to be deceived again? And through what deplorable madness had she thus ruined her life by continual sacrifices? She recalled all her instincts of luxury, all the privations of her soul, the sordidness of marriage, of the household, her dreams sinking into the mire like wounded swallows, all that she had longed for, all that she had denied herself, all that she might have had, and for what? For what? In the midst of the silence that hung over the village, a heart-rending cry rose on the air. Bovary turned white to fainting. She knit her brows with a nervous gesture, then went on. And it was for him, for this creature, for this man who understood nothing, who felt nothing. For he was there, quite quiet, not even suspecting that the ridicule of his name would henceforth sully hers as well as his. She had made efforts to love him, and she had repented with tears for having yielded to another. "But it was perhaps a vulgus," suddenly exclaimed Bovary, who was meditating. At the unexpected shock of this phrase, falling on her thought like a leaden bullet on a silver plate, Emma, shuddering, raised her head in order to find out what he meant to say, and they looked at the other in silence, almost amazed to see each other, so far sundered were they by their inner thoughts. Charles gazed at her with the dull look of a drunken man, while he listened motionless to the last cries of the sufferer that followed each other in long-drawn modulations, broken by sharp spasms like the far-off howling of some beast being slaughtered. Emma bit her wan lips, and rolling between her fingers a piece of coral that she had broken, fixed on Charles the burning glance of her eyes like two arrows of fire about to dart forth. Everything in him irritated her now, his face, his dress, what he did not say, his whole person, his existence, in fine. She repented of her past virtue as of a crime, and what still remained of it crumbled away beneath the furious blows of her pride. She revelled in all the evil ironies of triumphant adultery. The memory of her lover came back to her with dazzling attractions. She threw her whole soul into it, borne away towards this image with a fresh enthusiasm. And Charles seemed to her as much removed from her life, as absent for ever, as impossible and annihilated, as if he had been about to die and were passing under her eyes. There was a sound of steps on the pavement. Charles looked up, and through the lowered blinds he saw at the corner of the market in the broad sunshine Dr. Canivet, who was wiping his brow with his handkerchief. Homais, behind him, was carrying a large red box in his hand, and both were going towards the chemist's. Then, with a feeling of sudden tenderness and discouragement, Charles turned to his wife, saying to her, "Oh, kiss me, my own." "Leave me," she said, red with anger. "What is the matter?" he asked, stupefied. "Be calm, compose yourself. You know well enough that I love you. Come." "Enough," she cried with a terrible look. And escaping from the room, Emma closed the door so violently that the barometer fell from the wall and smashed on the floor. Charles sank back into his armchair, overwhelmed, trying to discover what could be wrong with her, fancying some nervous illness, weeping, and vaguely feeling something fatal and incomprehensible whirling round him. When Rodolphe came to the garden that evening, he found his mistress waiting for him at the foot of the steps on the lowest stair. They threw their arms round one another, and all their rancour melted like snow beneath the warmth of that kiss. Chapter 12. They began to love one another again. Often, even in the middle of the day, Emma suddenly wrote to him, then from the window made a sign to Justin, who, taking his apron off, quickly ran to La Huchette. Rodolphe would come. She had sent for him to tell him that she was bored, that her husband was odious, her life frightful. "But what can I do?" he cried one day impatiently. "Ah, if you would—" She was sitting on the floor between his knees, her hair loose, her look lost. "Why, what?" said Rodolphe. She sighed. "We would go and live elsewhere, somewhere." "You are really mad," he said, laughing. "How could that be possible?" She returned to the subject. He pretended not to understand, and turned the conversation. What he did not understand was all this worry about so simple an affair as love. She had a motive, a reason, and, as it were, a pendant to her affection. Her tenderness, in fact, grew each day with her repulsion to her husband. The more she gave up herself to the one, the more she loathed the other. Never had Charles seemed to her so disagreeable, to have such stodgy fingers, such vulgar ways, to be so dull as when they found themselves together after her meeting with Rodolphe. Then, while playing the spouse and virtue, she was burning at the thought of that head whose black hair fell in a curl over the sunburnt brow, of that form at once so strong and elegant, of that man, in a word, who had such experience in his reasoning, such passion in his desires. It was for him that she filed her nails with the care of a chaser, and that there was never enough cold cream for her skin, nor of patchouli for her handkerchiefs. She loaded herself with bracelets, rings, and necklaces. When he was coming, she filled the two large blue glass vases with roses, and prepared her room and her person like a courtesan expecting a prince. The servant had to be constantly washing linen. And all day Félicité did not stir from the kitchen, where little Justin, who often kept her company, watched her at work. With his elbows on the long board on which she was ironing, he greedily watched all these women's clothes spread out about him, the dimity petticoats, the fichus, the collars, and the drawers with running strings, wide at the hips and growing narrower below. "What is that for?" asked the young fellow, passing his hand over the crinoline or the hooks and eyes. "Why, haven't you ever seen anything?" Félicité answered, laughing. "As if your mistress, Madame Homais, didn't wear the same." "Oh, I dare say, Madame Homais," and he added with a meditative air, "as if she were a lady like Madame." But Félicité grew impatient of seeing him hanging round her. She was 6 years older than he, and Theodore, Monsieur Guillaumin's servant, was beginning to pay court to her. "Let me alone," she said, moving her pot of starch. "You'd better be off and pound almonds. You are always dangling about women. Before you meddle with such things, bad boy, wait till you've got a beard to your chin. Oh, don't be cross. I'll go and clean her boots." and he at once took down from the shelf Emma's boots, all coated with mud, the mud of the rendezvous, that crumbled into powder beneath his fingers, and that he watched as it gently rose in a ray of sunlight. "How afraid you are of spoiling them," said the servant, who wasn't so particular when she cleaned them herself, because as soon as the stuff of her boots was no longer fresh, Madame handed them over to her. Emma had a number in her cupboard that she squandered one after the other, without Charles allowing himself the slightest observation.
So, also, he disbursed 300 francs for a wooden leg that she thought proper to make a present of to Hippolyte. Its top was covered with cork, and it had spring joints, a complicated mechanism, covered over by black trousers ending in a patent leather boot.
But Hippolyte, not daring to use such a handsome leg every day, begged Madame Bovary to get him another more convenient one. The doctor, of course, had again to defray the expense of this purchase. So, little by little, the stableman took up his work again. One saw him running about the village as before, and when Charles heard from afar the sharp noise of the wooden leg, he at once went in another direction. It was Monsieur Lheureux, the shopkeeper, who had undertaken the order. This provided him with an excuse for visiting Emma. He chatted with her about the new goods from Paris, about 1,000 feminine trifles, made himself very obliging, and never asked for his money. Emma yielded to this lazy mode of satisfying all her caprices. Thus, she wanted to have a very handsome riding whip that was at an umbrella maker's at Rouen to give to Rodolphe. The week after, Monsieur Lheureux placed it on her table. But the next day he called on her with a bill for 270 francs, not counting the centimes. Emma was much embarrassed. All the drawers of the writing-table were empty. They owed over a fortnight's wages to Lestiboudois, 2 quarters to the servant, for any quantity of other things, and Bovary was impatiently expecting Monsieur de Roseret's account, which he was in the habit of paying every year about midsummer. She succeeded at first in putting off Lheureux. At last he lost patience. He was being sued, his capital was out, and unless he got some in, he should be forced to take back all the goods she had received. "Oh, very well, take them," said Emma. "I was only joking," he replied. "The only thing I regret is the whip. My word, I'll ask Monsieur to return it to me." "No, no," she said. "Ah, I've got you," thought Lheureux. And certain of his discovery, he went out, repeating to himself in an undertone and with his usual low whistle, "Good. We shall see. We shall see." She was thinking how to get out of this, when the servant, coming in, put on the mantelpiece a small roll of blue paper from Monsieur de Roseret's. Emma pounced upon and opened it. It contained 15 napoleons. It was the account. She heard Charles on the stairs, threw the gold to the back of her drawer, and took out the key. 3 days after, Lheureux reappeared. "I have an arrangement to suggest to you," he said. "If, instead of the sum agreed on, you would take..." "Here it is," she said, placing 14 napoleons in his hand. The tradesman was dumbfounded. Then, to conceal his disappointment, he was profuse in apologies and proffers of service, all of which Emma declined. Then she remained a few moments, fingering in the pocket of her apron the 2 5-franc pieces that he had given her in change. She promised herself she would economize in order to pay back later on. "Sure," she thought, "he won't think about it again." Besides the riding whip with its silver gilt handle, Rodolphe had received a seal with the motto "Amor nel cor." Furthermore, a scarf for a muffler, and finally a cigar case exactly like the Viscount's that Charles had formerly picked up in the road and that Emma had kept. These presents, however, humiliated him. He refused several. She insisted, and he ended by obeying, thinking her tyrannical and over-exacting. Then she had strange ideas. "When midnight strikes," she said, "you must think of me." And if he confessed that he had not thought of her, there were floods of reproaches that always ended with the eternal question, "Do you love me?" "Why, of course I love you," he answered. "A great deal?" "Certainly." "You haven't loved any others?" "Did you think you'd got a virgin?" he exclaimed, laughing. Emma cried, and he tried to console her, adorning his protestations with puns. "Oh," she went on, "I love you. I love you so that I could not live without you, do you see? There are times when I long to see you again, when I am torn by all the anger of love. I ask myself, where is he? Perhaps he is talking to other women. They smile upon him. He approaches. Oh, no, no one else pleases you. There are some more beautiful, but I love you best. I know how to love best. I am your servant, your concubine. You are my king, my idol. You are good, you are beautiful, you are clever, you are strong." He had so often heard these things said that they did not strike him as original. Emma was like all his mistresses, and the charm of novelty, gradually falling away like a garment, laid bare the eternal monotony of passion that has always the same forms and the same language. He did not distinguish, this man of so much experience, the difference of sentiment beneath the sameness of expression. Because lips libertine and venal had murmured such words to him, he believed but little in the candour of hers. Exaggerated speeches hiding mediocre affections must be discounted, as if the fullness of the soul did not sometimes overflow in the emptiest metaphors, since no one can ever give the exact measure of his needs, nor of his conceptions, nor of his sorrows, and since human speech is like a cracked tin kettle on which we hammer out tunes to make bears dance when we long to move the stars. But with that superior critical judgment that belongs to him who in no matter what circumstance holds back, Rodolphe saw other delights to be got out of this love. He thought all modesty in the way. He treated her quite sans façon. He made of her something supple and corrupt. Hers was an idiotic sort of attachment, full of admiration for him, of voluptuousness for her, a beatitude that benumbed her. Her soul sank into this drunkenness, shrivelled up, drowned in it, like Clarence in his butt of Malmsey. By the mere effect of her love, Madame Bovary's manners changed. Her looks grew bolder, her speech more free. She even committed the impropriety of walking out with Monsieur Rodolphe, a cigarette in her mouth, as if to defy the people. At last, those who still doubted, doubted no longer when one day they saw her getting out of the Hirondelle, her waist squeezed into a waistcoat like a man. And Madame Bovary Senior, who after a fearful scene with her husband had taken refuge at her son's, was not the least scandalized of the women folk. Many other things displeased her. First, Charles had not attended to her advice about the forbidding of novels. Then the ways of the house annoyed her. She allowed herself to make some remarks, and there were quarrels, especially one on account of Félicité. Madame Bovary Senior, the evening before, passing along the passage, had surprised her in company of a man with a brown collar, about 40 years old, who, at the sound of her step, had quickly escaped through the kitchen. Then Emma began to laugh, but the good lady grew angry, declaring that unless morals were to be laughed at, one ought to look after those of one's servants. "Where were you brought up?" asked the daughter-in-law, with so impertinent a look that Madame Bovary asked her if she were not perhaps defending her own case. "Leave the room!" said the young woman, springing up with a bound. "Emma! Mamma!" cried Charles, trying to reconcile them. But both had fled in their exasperation. Emma was stamping her feet as she repeated, "Oh, what manners! What a peasant!" He ran to his mother. She was beside herself. She stammered, "She is an insolent, giddy-headed thing, or perhaps worse." And she was for leaving at once if the other did not apologize. So Charles went back again to his wife and implored her to give way. He knelt to her. She ended by saying, "Very well, I'll go to her." And in fact, she held out her hand to her mother-in-law with the dignity of a marchioness as she said, "Excuse me, madame." Then, having gone up again to her room, she threw herself flat on her bed and cried there like a child, her face buried in the pillow. She and Rodolphe had agreed that, in the event of anything extraordinary occurring, she should fasten a small piece of white paper to the blind, so that if by chance he happened to be in Yonville, he could hurry to the lane behind the house. Emma made the signal. She had been waiting 3/4 of an hour when she suddenly caught sight of Rodolphe at the corner of the market. She felt tempted to open the window and call him, but he had already disappeared. She fell back in despair. Soon, however, it seemed to her that someone was walking on the pavement. It was he, no doubt. She went downstairs, crossed the yard. He was there outside. She threw herself into his arms. "Do take care," he said. "Ah, if you knew," she replied. And she began telling him everything, hurriedly, disjointedly, exaggerating the facts, inventing many, and so prodigal of parentheses that he understood nothing of it. "Come, my poor angel, courage. Be comforted, be patient." "But I have been patient. I have suffered for 4 years. A love like ours ought to show itself in the face of heaven. They torture me. I can bear it no longer. Save me." She clung to Rodolphe. Her eyes, full of tears, flashed like flames beneath a wave. Her breasts heaved. He had never loved her so much, so that he lost his head and said, "What is it? What do you wish?" "Take me away," she cried. "Carry me off. Oh, I pray you." And she threw herself upon his mouth, as if to seize there the unexpected consent if breathed forth in a kiss. "But," Rodolphe resumed, "what?" "Your little girl." She reflected a few moments, then replied, "We will take her. It can't be helped." "What a woman," he said to himself, watching her as she went, for she had run into the garden. Someone was calling her. On the following days, Madame Bovary senior was much surprised at the change in her daughter-in-law. Emma, in fact, was showing herself more docile, and even carrying her deference so far as to ask for a recipe for pickled gherkins. Was it the better to deceive them both, or did she wish by a sort of voluptuous stoicism to feel the more profoundly the bitterness of the things she was about to leave? But she paid no heed to them. On the contrary, she lived as lost in the anticipated delight of her coming happiness. It was an eternal subject for conversation with Rodolphe. She leant on his shoulder, murmuring, "Ah, when we are in the mail coach, do you think about it? Can it be? It seems to me that the moment I feel the carriage start, it will be as if we were rising in a balloon, as if we were setting out for the clouds. Do you know that I count the hours? And you?" Never had Madame Bovary been so beautiful as at this period. She had that indefinable beauty that results from joy, from enthusiasm, from success, and that is only the harmony of temperament with circumstances. Her desires, her sorrows, the experience of pleasure, and her ever-young illusions, that had, as soil and rain and winds and the sun make flowers grow, gradually developed her, and she at length blossomed forth in all the plenitude of her nature. Her eyelids seemed chiselled expressly for her long, amorous looks in which the pupil disappeared, while a strong inspiration expanded her delicate nostrils and raised the fleshy corner of her lips, shaded in the light by a little black down. One would have thought that an artist, apt in conception, had arranged the curls of hair upon her neck. They fell in a thick mass, negligently, and with the changing chances of their adultery that unbound them every day. Her voice now took more mellow inflections, her figure also. Something subtle and penetrating escaped even from the folds of her gown and from the line of her foot. Charles, as when they were first married, thought her delicious and quite irresistible. When he came home in the middle of the night, he did not dare to wake her. The porcelain nightlight threw a round, trembling gleam upon the ceiling, and the drawn curtains of the little cot formed, as it were, a white hut standing out in the shade, and by the bedside Charles looked at them. He seemed to hear the light breathing of his child. She would grow big now. Every season would bring rapid progress. He already saw her coming from school as the day drew in, laughing, with ink stains on her jacket and carrying her basket on her arm. Then she would have to be sent to a boarding school. That would cost much. How was it to be done? Then he reflected. He thought of hiring a small farm in the neighbourhood that he would superintend every morning on his way to his patients. He would save up what he brought in. He would put it in the savings bank. Then he would buy shares somewhere, no matter where. Besides, his practice would increase. He counted upon that, for he wanted Berta to be well educated, to be accomplished, to learn to play the piano. Ah, how pretty she would be later on when she was 15, when, resembling her mother, she would, like her, wear large straw hats in the summertime. From a distance they would be taken for two sisters. He pictured her to himself, working in the evening by their side beneath the light of the lamp. She would embroider him slippers. She would look after the house. She would fill all the home with her charm and her gaiety. At last they would think of her marriage. They would find her some good young fellow with a steady business. He would make her happy. This would last for ever. Emma was not asleep. She pretended to be. And while he dozed off by her side, she awakened to other dreams. To the gallop of four horses, she was carried away for a week towards a new land whence they would return no more. They went on and on, their arms entwined without a word. Often, from the top of a mountain, there suddenly glimpsed some splendid city with domes and bridges and ships, forests of citron trees and cathedrals of white marble, on whose pointed steeples were storks' nests. They went at a walking pace because of the great flagstones, and on the ground there were bouquets of flowers, offered you by women dressed in red bodices. They heard the chiming of bells, the neighing of mules, together with the murmur of guitars and the noise of fountains, whose rising spray refreshed heaps of fruit arranged like a pyramid at the foot of pale statues that smiled beneath playing waters. And then one night they came to a fishing village, where brown nets were drying in the wind along the cliffs and in front of the huts. It was there that they would stay. They would live in a low, flat-roofed house, shaded by a palm tree, in the heart of a gulf by the sea. They would row in gondolas, swing in hammocks, and their existence would be easy and large as their silk gowns, warm and star-spangled as the nights they would contemplate. However, in the immensity of this future that she conjured up, nothing special stood forth. The days, all magnificent, resembled each other like waves, and it swayed in the horizon, infinite, harmonized, azure, and bathed in sunshine. But the child began to cough in her cot, or Bovary snored more loudly, and Emma did not fall asleep till morning, when the dawn whitened the windows, and when little Justin was already in the square, taking down the shutters of the chemist's shop. She had sent for Monsieur Lheureux, and had said to him, "I want a cloak, a large lined cloak with a deep collar." "You are going on a journey?" he asked. "No, but—" "Never mind. I may count on you, may I not, and quickly?" He bowed. "Besides, I shall want," she went on, "a trunk, not too heavy, handy." "Yes, yes, I understand. About 3 feet by 1.5 feet, as they are being made just now. And a travelling bag." "Decidedly," thought Lheureux, "there's a row on here." "And," said Madame Bovary, taking her watch from her belt, "take this. You can pay yourself out of it." But the tradesman cried out that she was wrong. They knew one another. Did he doubt her? What childishness! She insisted, however, on his taking at least the chain, and Lheureux had already put it in his pocket and was going when she called him back.
"You will leave everything at your place. As to the cloak," she seemed to be reflecting, "do not bring it either. You can give me the maker's address and tell him to have it ready for me."
It was the next month that they were to run away. She was to leave Yonville as if she was going on some business to Rouen. Rodolphe would have booked the seats, procured the passports, and even have written to Paris in order to have the whole mail coach reserved for them as far as Marseille, where they would buy a carriage and go on thence without stopping to Genoa. She would take care to send her luggage to Lheureux's, whence it would be taken direct to the Hirondelle, so that no one would have any suspicion. And in all this there never was any allusion to the child. Rodolphe avoided speaking of her. Perhaps he no longer thought about it. He wished to have 2 more weeks before him to arrange some affairs. Then, at the end of a week, he wanted 2 more. Then he said he was ill. Next he went on a journey. The month of August passed, and after all these delays they decided that it was to be irrevocably fixed for the 4th of September, a Monday. At length, the Saturday before arrived. Rodolphe came in the evening earlier than usual. "Everything is ready?" she asked him. "Yes." Then they walked round a garden bed and went to sit down near the terrace on the curbstone of the wall. "You are sad," said Emma. "No. Why?" And yet he looked at her strangely, in a tender fashion. "Is it because you are going away?" she went on. "Because you are leaving what is dear to you, your life? Ah, I understand. I have nothing in the world. You are all to me. So shall I be to you. I will be your people, your country. I will tend, I will love you." "How sweet you are," he said, seizing her in his arms. "Really," she said with a voluptuous laugh, "do you love me? Swear it, then." "Do I love you? Love you? I adore you, my love." The moon, full and purple-coloured, was rising right out of the earth at the end of the meadow. She rose quickly between the branches of the poplars that hid her here and there like a black curtain pierced with holes. Then she appeared, dazzling with whiteness in the empty heavens that she lit up, and now, sailing more slowly along, let fall upon the river a great stain that broke up into an infinity of stars, and the silver sheen seemed to writhe through the very depths like a headless serpent covered with luminous scales. It also resembled some monster candelabra, all along which sparkled drops of diamonds running together. The soft night was about them. Masses of shadow filled the branches. Emma, her eyes half closed, breathed in with deep sighs the fresh wind that was blowing. They did not speak, lost as they were in the rush of their reverie. The tenderness of the old days came back to their hearts, full and silent as the flowing river, with the softness of the perfume of the syringas, and threw across their memories shadows more immense and more sombre than those of the still willows that lengthened out over the grass. Often some night animal, hedgehog or weasel, setting out on the hunt, disturbed the lovers, or sometimes they heard a ripe peach falling all alone from the espalier. "Ah, what a lovely night," said Rodolphe. "We shall have others," replied Emma. And as if speaking to herself, "Yet it will be good to travel. And yet why should my heart be so heavy? Is it dread of the unknown, and the effect of habits left? Or rather, no, it is the excess of happiness. How weak I am I not? Forgive me." "There is still time," he cried. "Reflect, perhaps you may repent." "Never," she cried impetuously. And coming closer to him, "What ill could come to me? There is no desert, no precipice, no ocean I would not traverse with you. The longer we live together, the more it will be like an embrace. Every day closer, more heart to heart. There will be nothing to trouble us, no cares, no obstacle. We shall be alone all to ourselves eternally. Oh, speak, answer me." At regular intervals he answered, "Yes, yes." She had passed her hands through his hair, and she repeated in a childlike voice, despite the big tears which were falling, "Rodolphe, Rodolphe, ah, Rodolphe, dear little Rodolphe." Midnight struck. "Midnight," said she. "Come, it is tomorrow. One day more." He rose to go, and as if the movement he made had been the signal for their flight, Emma said, suddenly assuming a gay air, "You have the passports?" "Yes." "You are forgetting nothing?" "No." "Are you sure?" "Certainly." "It is at the Hotel de Provence, is it not, that you will wait for me at midday?" He nodded. "Till tomorrow, then," said Emma in a last caress, and she watched him go. He did not turn round. She ran after him, and leaning over the water's edge between the bulrushes, "Tomorrow," she cried. He was already on the other side of the river and walking fast across the meadow. After a few moments Rodolphe stopped, and when he saw her with her white gown gradually fade away in the shade like a ghost, he was seized with such a beating of the heart that he leant against a tree lest he should fall. "What an imbecile I am," he said with a fearful oath. "No matter. She was a pretty mistress." And immediately Emma's beauty, with all the pleasures of their love, came back to him. For a moment he softened. Then he rebelled against her. "For, after all," he exclaimed, gesticulating, "I can't exile myself, have a child on my hands." He was saying these things to give himself firmness. "And besides, the worry, the expense. Ah, no, 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 a thousand times no. It would have been too stupid." Chapter 13. No sooner was Rodolphe at home than he sat down quickly at his bureau under the stag's head that hung as a trophy on the wall. But when he had the pen between his fingers, he could think of nothing, so that, resting on his elbows, he began to reflect. Emma seemed to him to have receded into a far-off past, as if the resolution he had taken had suddenly placed a distance between them. To get back something of her, he fetched from the cupboard at the bedside an old Reims biscuit box, in which he usually kept his letters from women, and from it came an odour of dry dust and withered roses. First he saw a handkerchief with pale little spots. It was a handkerchief of hers. Once, when they were walking, her nose had bled. He had forgotten it. Near it, chipped at all the corners, was a miniature given him by Emma. Her toilette seemed to him pretentious, and her languishing look in the worst possible taste. Then, from looking at this image and recalling the memory of its original, Emma's features little by little grew confused in his remembrance, as if the living and the painted face, rubbing one against the other, had effaced each other. Finally, he read some of her letters. They were full of explanations relating to their journey, short, technical, and urgent, like business notes. He wanted to see the long ones again, those of old times. In order to find them at the bottom of the box, Rodolphe disturbed all the others, and mechanically began rummaging amidst this mass of papers and things, finding pell-mell bouquets, garters, a black mask, pins, and hair. Hair, dark and fair. Some, even, catching in the hinges of the box, broke when it was opened. Thus dallying with his souvenirs, he examined the writing and the style of the letters, as varied as their orthography. They were tender or jovial, facetious, melancholy. There were some that asked for love, others that asked for money. A word recalled faces to him, certain gestures, the sound of a voice. Sometimes, however, he remembered nothing at all. In fact, these women, rushing at once into his thoughts, cramped each other and lessened, as reduced to a uniform level of love that equalized them all. So, taking handfuls of the mixed-up letters, he amused himself for some moments with letting them fall in cascades from his right into his left hand. At last, bored and weary, Rodolphe took back the box to the cupboard, saying to himself, "What a lot of rubbish!" which summed up his opinion. For pleasures, like schoolboys in a school courtyard, had so trampled upon his heart that no green thing grew there, and that which passed through it, more heedless than children, did not even like them leave a name carved upon the wall. "Come," said he, "let's begin." He wrote, "Courage, Emma, courage. I would not bring misery into your life." "After all, that's true," thought Rodolphe. "I am acting in her interest. I am honest." "Have you carefully weighed your resolution? Do you know to what an abyss I was dragging you, poor angel? No, you do not, do you? You were coming confident and fearless, believing in happiness in the future. Ah, unhappy that we are, insensate!" Rodolphe stopped here to think of some good excuse. "If I told her all my fortune is lost. No, besides, that would stop nothing. It would all have to be begun over again later on. As if one could make women like that listen to reason." He reflected, then went on, "I shall not forget you. Oh, believe it, and I shall ever have a profound devotion for you. But some day, sooner or later, this ardour, such is the fate of human things, would have grown less, no doubt. Lassitude would have come to us, and who knows if I should not even have had the atrocious pain of witnessing your remorse, of sharing it myself, since I should have been its cause. The mere idea of the grief that would come to you tortures me, Emma. Forget me. Why did I ever know you? Why were you so beautiful? Is it my fault? Oh, my God, no, no, accuse only fate. That's a word that always tells," he said to himself. "Oh, if you had been one of those frivolous women that one sees, certainly I might, through egotism, have tried an experiment, in that case without danger for you. But that delicious exaltation, at once your charm and your torment, has prevented you from understanding, adorable woman that you are, the falseness of our future position. Nor had I reflected upon this at first, and I rested in the shade of that ideal happiness as beneath that of the manchineel tree, without foreseeing the consequences. Perhaps you'll think I'm giving it up from avarice. Ah, well, so much the worse, it must be stopped. The world is cruel, Emma. Wherever we might have gone, it would have persecuted us. You would have had to put up with indiscreet questions, calumny, contempt, insult, perhaps. Insult to you. Oh, and I, who would place you on a throne, I, who bear with me your memory as a talisman, for I am going to punish myself by exile for all the ill I have done you. I am going away. Whither, I know not. I am mad. Adieu. Be good always. Preserve the memory of the unfortunate who has lost you. Teach my name to your child. Let her repeat it in her prayers. The wicks of the candles flickered. Rodolphe got up to shut the window, and when he had sat down again, I think it's all right. Ah, and this, for fear she should come and hunt me up. I shall be far away when you read these sad lines, for I have wished to flee as quickly as possible to shun the temptation of seeing you again. No weakness. I shall return, and perhaps later on we shall talk together very coldly of our old love. Adieu. And there was a last adieu, divided into two words, adieu, which he thought in very excellent taste. Now, how am I to sign, he said to himself. Yours devotedly? No. Your friend? Yes, that's it. Your friend. He reread his letter. He considered it very good. Poor little woman, he thought with emotion. She'll think me harder than a rock. There ought to have been some tears on this, but I can't cry. It isn't my fault. Then, having emptied some water into a glass, Rodolphe dipped his finger into it and let a big drop fall on the paper that made a pale stain on the ink. Then, looking for a seal, he came upon the one Amor nel cor. That doesn't at all fit in with the circumstances. Phew, never mind. After which he smoked three pipes and went to bed. The next day, when he was up, at about 2 o'clock, he had slept late, Rodolphe had a basket of apricots picked. He put his letter at the bottom under some vine leaves, and at once ordered Girard, his ploughman, to take it with care to Madame Bovary. He made use of this means for corresponding with her, sending, according to the season, fruits or game. "If she asks after me," he said, "you will tell her that I have gone on a journey. You must give the basket to her herself into her own hands. Get along and take care." Girard put on his new blouse, knotted his handkerchief round the apricots, and walking with great heavy steps in his thick iron-bound galoshes, made his way to Yonville. Madame Bovary, when he got to her house, was arranging a bundle of linen on the kitchen table with Félicité. "Here," said the ploughboy, "is something for you from master." She was seized with apprehension, and as she sought in her pocket for some coppers, she looked at the peasant with haggard eyes, while he himself looked at her with amazement, not understanding how such a present could so move anyone. At last he went out. Félicité remained. She could bear it no longer. She ran into the sitting-room as if to take the apricots there, overturned the basket, tore away the leaves, found the letter, opened it, and as if some fearful fire were behind her, Emma flew to her room, terrified. Charles was there. She saw him. He spoke to her. She heard nothing, and she went on quickly up the stairs, breathless, distraught, dumb, and ever holding this horrible piece of paper that crackled between her fingers like a plate of sheet iron. On the second floor she stopped before the attic door that was closed. Then she tried to calm herself. She recalled the letter. She must finish it. She did not dare to. And where, how, she would be seen. Ah, no, here, she thought, I shall be all right. Emma pushed open the door and went in. The slates threw straight down a heavy heat that gripped her temples, stifled her. She dragged herself to the closed garret window. She drew back the bolt, and the dazzling light burst in with a leap. Opposite, beyond the roofs, stretched the open country till it was lost to sight. Down below, underneath her, the village square was empty. The stones of the pavement glittered. The weathercocks on the houses were motionless. At the corner of the street, from a lower story, rose a kind of humming with strident modulations. It was Binet turning. She leant against the embrasure of the window and re-read the letter with angry sneers. But the more she fixed her attention upon it, the more confused were her ideas. She saw him again, heard him, encircled him with her arms. and the throbs of her heart that beat against her breast like blows of a sledgehammer grew faster and faster with uneven intervals. She looked about her with the wish that the earth might crumble into pieces. Why not end it all? What restrained her? She was free. She advanced, looked at the paving stones, saying to herself, "Come, come." The luminous ray that came straight up from below drew the weight of her body towards the abyss. It seemed to her that the ground of the oscillating square went up the walls, and that the floor dipped on end like a tossing boat. She was right at the edge, almost hanging, surrounded by vast space. The blue of the heavens suffused her. The air was whirling in her hollow head. She had but to yield, to let herself be taken, and the humming of the lathe never ceased, like an angry voice calling her.
"Emma! Emma!" cried Charles.
She stopped.
"Wherever you are, come!"
The thought that she had just escaped from death almost made her faint with terror. She closed her eyes. Then she shivered at the touch of a hand on her sleeve. It was Félicité.
"Master is waiting for you, madame. The soup is on the table."
And she had to go down to sit at table. She tried to eat. The food choked her. Then she unfolded her napkin as if to examine the darns, and she really thought of applying herself to this work, counting the threads in the linen. Suddenly the remembrance of the letter returned to her. How had she lost it? Where could she find it? But she felt such weariness of spirit that she could not even invent a pretext for leaving the table. Then she became a coward. She was afraid of Charles. He knew all, that was certain. Indeed, he pronounced these words in a strange manner. "We are not likely to see Monsieur Rodolphe soon again, it seems."
"Who told you?" she said, shuddering.
"Who told me?" he replied, rather astonished at her abrupt tone. "Why, Girard, whom I met just now at the door of the Café Français. He has gone on a journey, or is to go." She gave a sob. "What surprises you in that? He absents himself like that from time to time for a change. And, ma foi, I think he's right when one has a fortune and is a bachelor. Besides, he has jolly times, as our friend. He's a bit of a rake. Monsieur Langlois told me—"
He stopped for propriety's sake, because the servant came in. She put back into the basket the apricots scattered on the sideboard. Charles, without noticing his wife's colour, had them brought to him, took one, and bit into it.
"Oh, perfect," said he. "Just taste."
And he handed her the basket, which she put away from her gently. "Do just smell. What an odour," he remarked, passing it under her nose several times.
"I am choking," she cried, leaping up. But by an effort of will the spasm passed. Then, "It is nothing," she said, "it is nothing. It is nervousness. Sit down and go on eating." For she dreaded lest he should begin questioning her, attending to her, that she should not be left alone. Charles, to obey her, sat down again, and he spat the stones of the apricots into his hands, afterwards putting them on his plate. Suddenly, a blue tilbury passed across the square at a rapid trot. Emma uttered a cry and fell back rigid to the ground. In fact, Rodolphe, after many reflections, had decided to set out for Rouen. Now, as from La Huchette to Buchy, there is no other way than by Yonville. He had to go through the village, and Emma had recognised him by the rays of the lanterns, which like lightning flashed through the twilight. The chemist, at the tumult which broke out in the house, ran thither. The table with all the plates was upset. Sauce, meat, knives, the salt and cruet stand were strewn over the room. Charles was calling for help. Berthe, scared, was crying, and Félicité, whose hands trembled, was unlacing her mistress, whose whole body shivered convulsively. "I'll run to my laboratory for some aromatic vinegar," said the druggist. Then, as she opened her eyes on smelling the bottle, "I was sure of it," he remarked. "That would wake any dead person for you." "Speak to us," said Charles. "Collect yourself. It is I, your Charles, who loves you. Do you know me? See, here is your little girl. Oh, kiss her." The child stretched out her arms to her mother to cling to her neck. But turning away her head, Emma said in a broken voice,
"No, no, no one."
She fainted again. They carried her to her bed. She lay there stretched at full length, her lips apart, her eyelids closed, her hands open, motionless and white as a waxen image.
Two streams of tears flowed from her eyes and fell slowly upon the pillow. Charles, standing up, was at the back of the alcove, and the chemist, near him, maintained that meditative silence that is becoming on the serious occasions of life. "Do not be uneasy," he said.